Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Thank you. It's good to be here. A lot of familiar faces and some others, and so I hope we can have a good evening here and time for your comments and questions as well. As Tim said, I started my career in Southeast Asia and East Asia, thought I was going to be an Asianist for my entire service. I went to Moscow actually as the Asia watcher in the political section. And then we had what we refer to as the greatest job creation program for diplomats since the fall of the British Empire, when the Soviet Union collapsed in the fall of 1991, and I ended up spending a good bit of the rest of my career somewhere in that geographic space, partly out in Tajikistan, the Central Asian side, but then in Lithuania. From 2001 to 2004, the period during which Lithuania was preparing to join both the European Union and NATO. And then I was in Finland a couple of years later when Finland took the rotating presidency of the European Union. And I'm going through this because it really had a lot of impact on my perception of the European Union. I think I had sort of what I would assert is a fairly common American view of, you know, Europe's a wonderful place to be a tourist, but you wouldn't want to live there. Bureaucracy, complexity, ponderous long meetings, and of course it's gray all winter, which is, I'm convinced, why the Europeans left to colonize the world. It was an acute vitamin D deficiency. But what I saw happening in Lithuania as the European Union was working to accept these recently independent countries that were coming out of their period under the Soviet rule and the Warsaw Pact experience, was what I saw was a tremendous effort and a commitment and an expenditure of money and people to help these countries get ready to make that transition. When I arrived there in 2001 and all the way through that period, there were all kinds of European Union specialists and consultants and experts that were in there, because every country that was joining had to regularize and standardize its legal systems and its procedures to meet the terms of the European Union's acquis, the French term they use for all of these. It's loosely a constitution, but it's, you know, it's actually a bookshelf full of the documentation. They're really good at paper. You know, we complain about Washington, you haven't seen anything. But not only were there people there helping out, but there was actual real money. The European Union put money, they helped these countries do the things that would allow them to become functioning parts of this European space. So they were everything down to, you know, road fixing, getting the roads up to a standard that would permit truck traffic across those borders and those borders of diminished significance. And it really offered something to these countries. I compared that with what these countries needed to do to get ready to join NATO. To join NATO, you have to show a lot of things, including that you're prepared to spend, or at least aim towards spending, 2% of your gross domestic product on your military budget. And, you know, countries like Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, the Baltics there, they of course hadn't had any military at all because it had been a Soviet military. You know, the Czech Republic at least had had, nominally speaking, a Czech army if it was under Warsaw Pact jurisdiction. But to join NATO, we expect countries to spend money. And one of the little secrets of that, of course, is that some of that money they have to spend on products that we're happy to sell them. You know, if you want a NATO-compliant radio on the right frequencies, well, you can't go down to the local Best Buy and get it in Vilnius, Lithuania. You get to get it from the Pentagon's Best Buy shop or the whoever their vendor is. So I developed a real affection for what the European Union really tried to be. It really saw itself as having a vocation of saving Europe from what it had seen. And we're going to move on to that in a little bit more detail in a minute. Another piece of this that was significant and remains so today is, and you may have a copy of this little sketch outline to follow along a bit where I'm headed, was they talked about a Europe of nations. And nation here is not to be confused with a nation state, although there are those as well. But nations meaning the numerous ethnic identities that had been part of Europe and to some extent had been part of the reason for Europe's wars over the centuries. And it was an effort to actually say, no, every nation, every ethnic group, every ethnos is going to have a place in this union of Europeans. And was another piece of this sense of we have to overcome what we have done to each other for the last decades or centuries. So that's my background and my approach to some of these European topics and issues. The next thing I want to talk about very quickly is, and this is, I think, a useful thing to think about whenever you're talking about any situation, and particularly one of a different cultural background than our own. Within the intelligence community, and part of my career in Washington was spent in the State Department's branch of that, one of the things we always talk to each other about is how do we check our analysis? How do we make sure we're not simply seeing what we want to see? Because the tendency is to assume that everybody else looks at a problem or looks at the world or reacts to situations the same way we do. And to some degree, there's something to that, which is why it's so appealing to engage in what we call mirror imaging. But it's also a danger, and it's what I want to start with, thinking about how to avoid when we look at Europe. But my sort of standard example on this is to think about Afghanistan in the 1980s. Russia invades in 1979. We think this is a really bad idea. We want the Russians out of there. The Saudi Arabians also want the Russians out of there. They think it's an equally bad idea. So we get together and we run an operation that eventually does get the Russians out. The problem was that we had two very different reasons for wanting the Russians out. For us, we wanted to continue our political competition with the Soviet Union. We wanted to bloody the geopolitical effort there of Moscow. Saudis had a very different reason. They wanted to drive the infidels out of the Muslim nation of Afghanistan. Now, the goal of get the Russians out sounded the same, but the reasons were very different. And the consequences were that when the Russians were driven out in 1989, when they left, we were done. So we took off, and we all know what's happened since then. Things we didn't like, and we're now there and continuing our longest war ever. The Saudis had a different goal. They had made religious contacts in that area, and they were very happy to stay. And that turned into the Taliban later. So it's important to think about the differences of what we're looking at and how we approach an issue. And that's what I want to do, a little quick map work here. This is the United States in February of 1860. And you'll see it looks remarkably familiar. You know, it's kind of what we got now. We hadn't quite bought Alaska yet, and we hadn't annexed the Kingdom of Hawaii, but the borders of the United States are set, even if not internally all the states had not been resolved. Now, compare that to this map of Europe at about the same time. You will notice you've got, of course, a huge Russian Empire that includes, in this case, Finland. It's got a lot of territory down here. You've got, this is the Ottoman Empire, which still is running most of southeastern Europe. Greece has become independent back in the 1830s, but look at what Italy looks like. That's not the Italy of today. Modern Italy had not been formed in 1860. Germany, this is Prussia at the time. There is no Poland. And these states are still yet to be formed into what we know of as modern Germany. Even France, generally considered to be, you know, sort of the oldest core country of Europe, the most consistent one, those borders are not what we have later. Here's a more modern picture, and you see borders that look a little more familiar to us. But again, changes. This is pre-World War II. So my point is that while our experience was one basically of consistent expansion from the Atlantic coast across the sweep of the North American continent to the Pacific. Europeans had a very different experience. They have gone through a whole series of border changes, the rise and fall of empires, the changes in royal families, uprisings that led to changes in the nature of governance, things that we really have no grasp of almost whatsoever, I would assert. And although I'm sure all of you, like me, intellectually get that when we think about it, my point is that we often don't think about it much, and we assume that Europe is going to be able to resolve its issues in the same way that we work at resolving ours, when in fact they have a very different history and a very different experience. And this, I think, lies very fundamentally at the base of forming the European Union, or what started out as the European Coal and Steel Community and then developed into what we know today. Europe had had a fairly rugged 19th century. Remember, there were upheavals and uprisings in the late 1840s, 1850, major wars in 1870. Things settled down for a while. The last couple of decades, the first 10 years of the 20th century were pretty good. And then, of course, we get what some people have called the second 30 years war. First one was back in the early 17th century, and this one is from 1914 to 1945. With kind of that interregnum that didn't really resolve anything. So, and much as we talk and remember what World War II meant to this country, it meant dramatically more and dramatically worse, of course, to Europe. We lost about 0.3%, about 3 per 1,000 people from the United States in the war. Great Britain lost 10 per. France, 14. Poland lost an eighth of its population, 125. Belarus lost a quarter of its population. The damage, I mean, every, you know, there's a reason why every French village you go through has a war cemetery, because they all lost significant numbers of people. And that is an experience that I think we really cannot grasp. More than intellectually, that amazing loss of people and the number of times the battle went back and forth across these lands. And so by 1945, there was a sense of, by God, we have got to do something. And the first sort of phrasing for this became, and this is, of course, in the immediate post-war period there, keep the Russians out, the Germans down, since they were seen as the primary cause of both world wars, and the U.S. in. They wanted the U.S. involved as a balance. And that was the mantra that gave us NATO. That was how it was going to work. NATO became the bulwark against the Russians. It kept the Germans included, but clearly subsidiary. And of course, we were a member and we stayed in. But then the European Union, in its origins, began to get rolling as well, still with a desire to have the U.S. involved, but feeling that there had to be something more to keep peace on the continent. And we'll talk a little more about the United Kingdom later, so we'll leave that for a moment. But this idea that something had to be done to stop these wars is what came to be known as the European vocation. And they really mean that word seriously. Vocation, from the Latin vocare, to call out. It was a calling to leave behind the bloodshed of centuries and find a way to function as a peaceful society. Just this last week, this showed up in a Financial Times column. 64 years ago, you're getting an idea of what he's playing off of here. Our fathers brought forth a new union to Europe, conceived in liberty and freedom, and dedicated to the proposition that never again should our continent be laid to ruin by divisions among its people. We are now engaged in a great debate testing whether that union or any so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. And here's kind of the punchline. It is a fitting testament to the EU's founders that the secession of one member state, the UK and Brexit, has resulted in dialogue, not civil war. And I would take that not as a snarky comment about the United States, but as an honest statement of relief. In decades past, centuries past, that's what it would have meant. It didn't this time, thank God, they are saying to each other. But part of what this means, and again, we'll come back to this when we talk about Brexit towards the end, is that there is, on the continent especially, a real sense that the EU is not just a trade pact. It's not just a way of moving stuff and moving people more easily. It actually is a calling to avoid bloodshed and war and build a better society for all those nations of Europe. And that even means a significant difference, I think, between the United Kingdom, which is, of course, an island and has always seen itself as a little bit apart from the continent. It's not been invaded, of course, successfully since 1066, whereas the continent has seen invasion after invasion after invasion from its own neighbors. But nonetheless, the experience is not pleasant. So in the early 50s, the coal and steel community is formed, and then gradually we see the development of what we now know as the EU. This is obviously the map of the expansion of the European Union up to its current form, and we'll talk more about that in just a second. But I want to give you sort of a real quick historical sweep from the late 40s, turn of the 50s, up until today. I think it's also a set of periods that are important for the United States, but we'll focus here, obviously, on Europe. The first period is that wonderful 30 years that ran from the late 40s to the late 70s. The French call it the 30 glorieuses, the 30 glorious years, during which Europe was at peace. It was recovering from the damage of World War II. Just like here, you had family formation again. People got married. They had kids. They had their own kind of baby boom. The economies got back on their feet with help from us, but also with a lot of hard work on their part. And they began to form this community that gave some sense of assurance that despite what was, you know, over here in the Soviet sphere and the Warsaw Pact, that nonetheless, Europe was going to be able to put something together that was going to be peaceful, prosperous, and durable. And I would suggest that in Europe, as I think in the United States, people are still to a large degree, particularly the folks of the generation that are still running things, people from their 50s into their 70s, are still living out of that era, that the Trente Glorieuses. It was a time when things just seemed really good. The economic pie was expanding, bringing in new people, doing new things. All of that was not hard. What brought that to an end is one of those mysteries that historians will work on. You can make a case that the 1979 second oil shock certainly was a marker in the United States and a marker in Europe as well, although their energy situation's a bit different. But the 1980s became kind of a period of flatness in terms of economic growth, in terms of wage growth on both sides of the Atlantic. But at least it was stable. And the Soviet Union seemed to be getting weaker, which wasn't a bad thing. And then we get to 1989. 1989, of course, the Berlin Wall falls. It falls on what the Europeans refer to as their 9/11, the 9th of November. Not September 11th, the 9th of November in European notation. So 1989 is sort of, that's kind of in a way the true end of World War II. The division of Europe that had followed that war ends very promptly, and by 1991, of course, the Soviet Union has collapsed and we're into a whole new world of relationships among nations. Period of great elation. In Europe, excitement in the United States, conviction that we had won the Cold War, and as one famous author put it in his book title, the end of history. You know, anything important was done, Western liberal democracy had won, and everybody else was just going to have to adapt to that. I would make a case that what happened then was a geopolitical bubble. An excess of enthusiasm that trumped good judgment in Europe. And folks, in my mother's phrase, they bit off more than they could chew, or their eyes were bigger than their stomach. And this happened with two international organizations. It happened with NATO, largely during the 90s and then continuing into the early 2000s. We were a big part of that. But it also happened with the European Union. You can see where the expansion had been earlier. Here's you've got your core members. You add Denmark and Ireland and the UK in 73. Greece gets in 81. Portugal and Spain in 86. A little more in 95 when Finland and Sweden come in. But the big one, the one that I was in Lithuania for, was this one in 2004, followed by Bulgaria and Romania in 2007. Now, as I said, the European Union actually spends money in bringing countries in, and it spends money on its own members. The poorer regions of member countries get assistance from Brussels for economic development and trying to bring them up to something approaching an average EU level. Well, you can see there hadn't been any expansion since 95 until 2004, a pretty long period. And in this interval from 86 to 95, they brought in countries that, you know, by and large, were pretty sophisticated, pretty well functioning already, high economic per capita income levels, high literacy and everything else. In 2004, they're bringing in a much more mixed group. Generally the stronger end of the old Eastern European countries, but nonetheless a bit of a challenge in some cases. And then in 2007, a real challenge with Bulgaria and Romania, two countries that are not Western in their cultural heritage. They're Orthodox Christian, they're not Latin Christian, unlike everybody before that. They have much lower economic development levels than anybody that had been taken in previously, and they are incredibly corrupt. Organized crime are us could be kind of the slogan for both of those. And so during the 90s, you've got this excitement and this elation, this sense that we're on a roll, things are going to be great. The big expansion in 2004, some more expansion in 2007, then we get the Great Recession in 2008. And while the precise causes and the precise impact are a little bit different in Europe than here, the effect is much the same nonetheless. A sharp crash in the economic growth rate. You can see what that at least I guess you could say it was a nice sharp V. But the recovery was not back to this level of 4% plus growth that they'd been having back in 2000, 2001, but was at best a tenuous effort to get back to 2%. And life is a lot more difficult in any body politic when the pie isn't getting bigger. You know, if the pie's enlarging, you can do a lot, and people generally feel fairly good. But when the pie is static or, God forbid, shrinking, it gets tough. People are unhappy. People are stressed. People look for alternative answers to the problems they're facing. And it doesn't make for stable politics or orderly progress either. There's even been books written on how people under stress tend not to make good decisions. There's good reason to believe that that's true. This is European youth unemployment. You'll see how bad it's gotten. Look at these countries here in particular. This part of Europe is a lot better. The Eurozone as a whole, though, you see is 24-25% youth unemployment in 2013. These are staggering numbers. I don't think most of us can even conceive of how that can be the case. But it even if the way of life is a little bit different, the social safety net is a lot stronger, people in Europe are much more likely to live at home until they marry anyway. That's not just a consequence of the Great Recession. So the experience is a little bit different than ours, but it's still not good. And this is, again, just a taste of what that means. And then here's unemployment rates in the UK, the US, and the Eurozone, showing, again, how bad they have been and how much distress and decline they have had to face. This has then led to a whole variety of discontents with the European Union, most of which, maybe all of which, were their prior to 2008, but they've really risen to the surface in the last, you know, 8 or 9 years and become topics of considerable dismay. The most obvious, I suspect, is the euro. The euro, in the view of many economists, was, as they like to put it, conceived in sin. It was a political goal with an economic, you know, a political mother and an economic father, and we didn't get a donkey, we got something much more complex. We got, this developed, really, out of what happened back in 1989-90. The idea of a European currency had been around for a long time. It was kind of a goal of this European vocation, of bringing everybody into a single economic, political space. But it has a lot of technical problems and challenges that economists will point out, and it had not really caught fire. But it was particularly, and some of you, depending on your attitude towards France, may find this understandable, it was a particularly French project. And I'm kind of a Francophile, but you may have heard the old saying that, you know, the French were trying to figure out how a bumblebee could fly, and they say, we understand that it flies, but it can't fly. In principle, it can't fly, so it can't be flying. You know, the love of theory is a French trait. And, you know, the theoretical attractions of a euro were overwhelming to the French, while they were very unappealing, in particular, to the Germans. Germany had, of course, risen out of World War II, gotten the Deutschmark back to being a credible currency, and in fact, the strongest, most solid currency. You know, to talk about, you know, solid economic and budgetary planning, you know, sort of the Deutschmark was the shorthand for that. While other currencies fluctuated and went up and down and had their problems, the Deutschmark was solid. And that was critically important to the German public, which still had historical memories of Weimar-era inflation. And it was a good thing in general to have a good, strong, solid currency there that people could invest in their bonds, they could put money into savings, you know, et cetera. But the Germans really didn't like this. But in 1989, with the collapse of the Berlin Wall and of the Eastern Bloc, the reunification of Germany became a possibility. Now, most of us who are not following these affairs very closely probably assumed it was just kind of obvious that that's what would happen. But there were a lot of people who did not want it to happen, including the British government at the time and a number of other states. They thought this was really not a very good idea. That, remember, going back to keep the Russians out, the Germans down. Well, reunifying Germany, they were afraid, would mean, once again, a German-dominated Central Europe, which might not be something they wanted to see over the long haul. But Germany wanted to be reunited, and the French found a deal. We'll let you reunite if we get a euro, if we will move towards having a single European currency. Now, you probably know that not every EU country joined. The UK did not, Denmark did not, some others did, but the euro was developed and was deployed. There was hot argumentation at the time, economists in favor, economists opposed, politicians in favor, politicians opposed, but it did happen. It was, I think everybody would agree, flawed, or a more polite word might be complex, complicated, pros and cons from the start. And right now the debate is sort of between those who say it is salvageable and those who say it's not. Some people say, yes, it was flawed, but unwinding it would be far too difficult to do. Others say it was flawed and we've got to unwind it in order to save Europe. You know, we have to destroy the euro in order to save it, to save Europe anyway. I just heard this afternoon driving home, our ambassador designate to the European Union was making a statement that he thought, I didn't know we had one, to be perfectly honest. This one slipped by me. At least that's how he was identified on the radio. And it was a respectable channel. So he was saying he couldn't see, he thought Greece would have to get out of the euro. Now, it's not that that hasn't been talked about, but with all due respect, ambassadors designate do not normally discuss the affairs of other nations or other international organizations, at least not until they're confirmed, for Pete's sakes. But in any case, we are in a new era in a variety of ways. But that is one of the topics. Is the Greek economy so small and so damaged, mostly by things that Greece did by itself, mind you? They fudged their books to get into the European Union. They fudged their books to get into the euro. They had expert advice from Goldman Sachs as to how to do that. This is serious. I'm not kidding. You know, how to move deficit parts of the budget off budget, you know, sort of the way Enron was able to move special purpose vehicles off the balance sheet until suddenly they went broke anyway. So Greece did a whole bunch of that stuff. It doesn't deserve a huge amount of sympathy, but other things happened that weren't its fault. And the question is, how does it get fixed? And can it be fixed? So that's one, you know, hot topic. It actually is probably not the major issue between amongst the core countries of the European Union, you know, the Netherlands, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. But it is certainly a topic that absorbs the energies of a lot of the financial economic leadership of the European Union. The second discontent across a lot of places in the EU, but especially the UK, is migration. And when I say migration, we're not actually talking about these refugees coming from outside. That's a real problem too, but a different one. Part of the goal, again, of this European vocation was the free movement of people, as well as knowledge and labor, and a real effort to have people enjoy and take advantage of and be part of that broader space. To get a university degree anywhere in the European Union, a student must spend one term outside their home country. The Erasmus program, it's a mandatory part of getting a university degree. Think of that. I mean, what a marvelous way of trying to broaden the experience of every student, but also to knit together these countries that have been neighbors, but often enemies, you know, for hundreds of years. So that idea of free movement is really critical. When I was in Lithuania and knew young Europeans, that EU passport or that ability, you know, you could go and live in practically about 20 countries, no questions asked. And you could vote in local elections, not in national, but in local elections, automatically, just by moving in there and settling down. So again, a vocation, a calling. But, of course, not all parts of the new EU were of the same economic levels of development. When the Schengen Agreement, the name for this ability to move without immigration controls and such, was coming into force, the United Kingdom was not at all sure that this was a very good idea. A lot of pressure to try and strike some kind of a deal limiting migration. But there was a lot of optimistic talk, and British Prime Minister said, oh, we might get 30,000 Poles moving in, you know, to take jobs. Well, in fact, they got about 200,000 Poles, and a lot of Romanians, and a bunch of Latvians, and it went on. And the Polish plumber was actually, well, you know, in our country, a figure in our election may have been, you know, the Middle Eastern terrorist. In the Brexit vote in the UK, the horror figure was the Polish plumber because of this influx of folks from within the European Union and this uncertainty that much cultural change could be withstood. A related but, as I say, different problem is this issue of what I'm calling the immigration challenge, not migration within the EU, but people coming in. And here, the European Union, and again, this is part of my point about mirror imaging at the beginning, the European Union has got a geography problem that isn't obviously of its own making. It's just where they live. But they live very close to Africa, and they live right next door to the Middle East. And both of those countries are, you know, kind of have a primary export right now. It's refugees and migrants. And that's a very difficult thing to contend with. We kind of know that ourselves from our southern border. But that group actually has, you know, sort of common connections with people across the border, may make it easier for them to be here in an undocumented fashion, but it also means they're absorbed and dealt with in a much easier fashion than if you have a bunch of Nigerians showing up, you know, on the streets of Paris. They don't speak French, they're not in a similar cultural background, et cetera, and it presents a whole set of challenges to European countries. Now, I was looking at a slide, a graph of how many foreign residents many of the European countries have. And of course, the highest level of foreign residents in Europe, I believe, is in Switzerland. But that's because lots of rich people want to go live in Switzerland. but there's also a surprising number of Portuguese and Spaniards who are working there. The service industries in Switzerland are not filled with Swiss, let me tell you. But these movements of people are creating challenges, even though in absolute terms they're probably a little smaller than you might think. France has about 11% non-French-born residents at the moment. We've got 14%. So it's not as if most European countries have got a larger percent of foreign-born than we have. But again, their lived experience is very different. In Finland, if you're a Finnish citizen and you say you're a Finn, well, that's also, well, you basically have two choices traditionally of ethnic groups. You're either an ethnic Finn or you might be an ethnic Swede. But if you're a Somali and you call yourself a Finn, do you feel like you're a Finn? Do the Finns feel like you're a Finn? It's a very different experience. Whatever our challenges are with diversity, we have a pretty solid sense that not everybody in the United States is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant anymore. But in many parts of Europe, while yes, they understand that intellectually, but it's not part of the lived historic identity of those nations of Europe. And so it's a different set of challenges socioculturally than we have in the United States. We have our own, but they take a different shape in terms of how they are perceived and understood. And then there's this constant complaint about the bureaucracy and sovereignty. We've given up our sovereignty. We can't run our own affairs anymore. The whole anti-Brussels urge. The Brussels bureaucracy is about 20,000 people. I think we have more state employees in Minnesota than 20,000. It really isn't very big, but the perception has become fairly common that it's a big problem. I think it's actually probably less of a problem, except in the UK, where it became such a touchstone. Europeans in general have a higher trust level in their government than Americans do. They're much more accustomed to the system being the way things work, and to sort of tolerating a level of governmental control that Americans wouldn't put up with. Part of the reason for that, of course, is they get a lot more out of their government in terms of things like medical care, guaranteed vacations, maternity leave. I mean, if you're Dutch, you get a vacation payment automatically deposited in your bank account every year to help underwrite that vacation, which you're guaranteed to have. So you have reason to tolerate a little more bureaucracy than we might have in this country. But the biggest issue, obviously, has been brought about by the Brexit vote of last June. And it's fascinating to read, if you go back and find any articles or monographs, books that were written in the last couple of years, they'll all talk about British discontent, and they'll all assume that, of course, Brexit was going to fail. Which means that you kind of have to go find more recent commentary to have anything that's relevant. Poor Theresa May has had to be, trying to find friends quickly for what might become this isolated United Kingdom. There was a lot of hope in some people in the UK anyway that they would be able to have a happy exit, the soft Brexit that they talk about. But it, again, given the European vocation on the continent side, I think they're not likely to be so successful. It was even somewhat amusing. There's an article in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago that was talking about one of the problems this person asserts in Great Britain, in the UK, is that the Brits, of course, speak English, and kind of like Americans, assume everyone else does, since English has become pretty much of a dominant language in Brussels as well. And he said, he talked about how the Chinese, the Brits really were just not rational about what was going to happen. Britain has its own problems with English. Its twin centers of political power, Westminster and the tabloid newspapers, catch that, twin centers of political power. Westminster and the tabloid newspapers are almost entirely monolingual. Brits, therefore, voted for Brexit blithely unaware of how other European countries would respond. The Brexiter fantasy broadly went like this: we'll stop immigration, keep free trade with Europe, and sign whizzo new trade deals with everybody else. But then he goes on, Britain does have a coterie of multilingual experts, mostly diplomats, who knew this wouldn't fly. But precisely because these people understand European thinking, they are distrusted by Westminster and the tabloids. So that is, again, a case of that mirror imaging and assuming that everyone else thinks the way you do. They're concerned about, you know, getting it right, hard, soft, or easy Brexit. Which country will leave next? That was a, you know, a Trump administration question, which I think really is a classic case of mirror imaging. We see the European Union the way we sort of see the United Kingdom, and it just checked out. But a lot of people would say the United Kingdom never really joined the European Union. It joined a trade relationship, a transactional deal to get access to the common market. It never felt the European vocation that the continent felt. And that may be another recent article I found an interesting talk is titled 2016, the year Europe forgot World War II. And the Brits, of course, having always been a little bit apart from all of that, probably forgot it more easily than others. Which country will leave next? Illiberal democracy in the continent. There is a lot going on there that is akin to what we are seeing in parts of the American political horizon. We've got Dutch elections coming up in March, and Geert Wilders is the leader of their anti-immigrant, anti-EU party. Now, nobody expects him to get, or his party to get, more than maybe 30% of the seats, in fact, less than that, 20% of the seats in the parliament. But it's a very multi-party setup that requires coalition building, which will probably take a couple of months. He might be kept out of the government. If not, that would mean something. The next up, of course, is the French presidential elections. It's going to happen in late April and May, and Marine Le Pen is head of the anti-EU France for the French party there. Were she to win the presidency, I think everybody agrees that would be probably, if the EU wouldn't be killed by that, it would certainly be on life support, because she actively wants France to withdraw. That said, you may recall a few presidential elections back when her father got into the runoff, and everybody that wasn't of her father's party joined together, and over 80% of the vote was cast for his opponent. Will the French do that again if Le Pen makes it into the final? Will all of the conservative, centrist, and left pull together to defeat her? I think that's where a lot of people would put their money, but then those same people were betting against Brexit. So it's hard to say. The Russians are also, of course, playing a certain role here. This is a picture prior to her actually becoming PM, but you'll see the flowers in the back are because it was taken in China. And that in and of itself is of some significance, because the UK had already been trying to make friends with China in a very big way, ways that we didn't like very much, we the United States government. And post-Brexit, it needs to make friends with anybody it can make friends with even faster, for trade relationships in particular. And so Theresa May has got quite a tough spot to be in right now, trying to figure out how to get United Kingdom extracted from the EU and yet not have it so cut off from trade links that the economy will take a significant hit. And that's going to be its principal challenge. So the other factor that is affecting Europe and that we're seeing here is this rise of populism and this debate over what is the future of the liberal world order. And by liberal, I mean a more or less law-based order, which tends to treat all nation states as reasonably equal, trying to have a network of relationships that are as extensive as possible. And what we're seeing right now appears to be a turn inwards on the part of a number of parties. I think my personal position is that, somewhat like this article about the year Europe forgot World War II, that a lot of popular thinking these days is underestimating the value of what has been accomplished over the past 65 years, post-World War II. That what we have in the European Union, in the trade agreements across the Atlantic, up and down the Western Hemisphere, and so forth, are of greater value than we may realize. We're so used to them, we don't understand what the alternatives might be. But that happens. bubbles, that overconfidence that was at sort of year 40, post the formation of NATO and the European Union, that has really cost a lot, cost people a lot in their confidence and their trust in their institutions, and they're not as comfortable with where we were. If you want to really be gloomy, in 1914, when Europe was, as the book title says, sleepwalking into World War I, there's a famous quote from a senior British figure, "The lights are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our time." And that was at the end of about 25 years of some of the most productive, most globalized time in modern history, about 1880 1914, so 34 years. And yet, Europe walked itself into war, and we lost the next 30 years. We've now had 65 years or more of largely stability and progress, plenty of hiccups, but nonetheless. Have we forgotten enough that we are going to walk ourselves, I trust not into war, but walk ourselves away from what we had gained during this post-World War II period? So I'm done, and it's now your turn.